I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The Force awakens this hour, seventh in the Star Wars series that may be the only thing America does that everybody likes. As the wise man Chuck Klosterman put it, the record opening box office is bigger overseas than in the U.S., heading toward $2 billion in 3 weeks, which is only the money after all. Critics and kids of all ages love what's got to be the most familiar alternate universe ever created outside religion, like Tolkien's Rings, or Greek heroes of the Iliad and Odyssey, but of and for the modern day. How many takes on Star Wars are there? Count the ways this hour, starting with little kids back to school this week in Boston's Back Bay, sounding off for our producer, Pat Tomino.
There's a lot of boys in it, and I don't like it. Scary.
I've only seen the first movie, so I like the part when Death Star exploded.
My favorite character, and I think the coolest character, is Kylo Ren. I like his skills with the lightsaber.
I love Star Wars.
There's a lot of wars. There's lightsaber fights.
So who's your favorite character?
Yoda. He's a master Jedi. He says, okay, you do that one.
We must go to the Jedi Temple. We must.
What's Yoda like?
A master Jedi and very friendly. Very, very old grandpa.
I like how there's kind of make-believe, but still it's like real at the same time.
Like the Force. A very powerful force that goes through your body and surrounds everything.
Who's the good guys in Star Wars?
Jedis. Because they have blue lightsabers, green and purple. It's my favorite.
Favorite? My second favorite is Indiana Jones.
Yes, it's appropriate for kids.
Extremely!
And then there are yesterday's kids of many Star Wars generations, the novelist and tastemaker Dave Eggers of McSweeney's and the 826 After School Reading Crusade, checked in from the road. And after him, the writer, rock star Amanda Palmer of punk cabaret fame with the Dresden Dolls, calling from Los Angeles.
It was hugely important to me. I was 7 and 10 and 13 when the first three movies came out, so I was right in the middle of a generation that was most affected. It was a pretty enormous tidal shift in what we go to the movies for, I think, and what we would expect from them, sort of a change in blockbuster culture and all that. The first three were actually very nuanced. They had far more layers, I think, than a lot of the more contemporary blockbusters, and so they really got under your skin and sort of tapped into something on the subconscious level, and I think that's why people went and saw at least the first one in particular over and over. When I was a kid, everybody had to see Star Wars at least a dozen times, and if you didn't, you weren't considered cool. You know, everybody had to count how many times they saw it and verify it with ticket stubs, and, you know, whoever saw it the most times was the king.
I am Amanda Palmer, writer, blogger, Twitterer, author, and a singer. As a girl who broadcasted an allergy to all things nerdy and sci-fi, Star Wars was somehow the exception. The characters were so human, and because the writing was so good, and because it was this epic drama on par with Indiana Jones and classic kind of sexy stories.
Who did Amanda Palmer, the aspiring young punk queen, see in that mirror? I imagine you fixing on Princess Leia, but who was it?
Oh, God. No, I mean, Princess Leia was just this, like, cool and collected person that I could never relate to. She's, like, really well put together, like, still had her lip gloss on after battling giant things. I didn't feel like that at all. As a teenager, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be or sleep with Han Solo, but probably both. Egotistical and yet fallible and supremely cool and hangs out in bars that look like bars I would want to hang out in. I think that was probably my way of thinking at 15.
Amanda, I was looking for you in the cantina.
I was spiritually in the cantina, playing with that amazing band.
The wisdom on Star Wars is stacked up here like jets over O'Hare. Steve Burt, the poet and close reader of pop music and movies. The Canadian culture vulture, Jeet Heer. Also, the sci-fi podcaster, Eric Molinsky, who goes deep on Star Wars at the site Imaginary Worlds. And there will be more. We begin with the Harvard scholar of fairy tales, Maria Tatar, and the man who wrote The Panic Virus and co-runs the MIT graduate program in science writing, Seth Mnookin. Maria, welcome. This got to you last night. I can see it in your face.
I've become a true believer, like those children we just heard who crossed the threshold into other worlds. And they believe. It reminds me of how make-believe really is the beginning of making beliefs. There is something so powerful about this new mythology. In 1977, the New York Times critic for the first film, the headline was that Star Wars created a new mythology, opened up a new world, a world that we can relate to.
Put it in context. What's the closest thing to it? It's fair to say, surely, that it's the most far-reaching fairy tale anybody's generated around here in the last century, probably. But how far back do you want to place it?
Oh, well, you know, there are other franchises. I mean, we could look at Lord of the Rings, and we can think of the Hunger Games. I would go back to fairy tales. This is a reminder of the storytelling instinct and of how we need stories, because otherwise there's no light in the darkness. It gives us the light in the darkness. So these are tales that are constantly transmitted and then rebooted. We make sequels. Take Little Red Riding Hood, a girl, a wolf, an encounter in the woods. How many times have we rewritten that story? And now Star Wars has been, you know, somehow Abrams hit the refresh button. And now we can keep telling that story in new ways.
Seth Mnookin, you were born knowing this thing, but you write to me that you're wrestling with day and night now. Where?
Yeah, I was a little bit younger, or I still am a little bit younger than Dave Eggers. I was 5 when it came out, and I only saw it 7 times in the theaters, not 12 times.
You weren't a king, man.
Right, exactly. But it had a deeply profound effect on me at the time. It was the first time, I think, that I had been exposed to ambiguity and to the kind of wrestling with big moral questions that movie brings up. It's interesting. Amanda talked about wanting to either be or sleep with Han Solo. And at my 6-year-old birthday party, which was a Star Wars party, I forbid anyone else from coming as Han Solo because I knew that that's who I was going to be. Since I've seen the new movie, I've found myself, it feels like almost continually, in discussions with people about the backstories, the mythologies, about Rey's place. And I guess we should say at this point that you should not be listening to this show if you have not yet seen Star Wars, because we will be the new movie, because we will be talking about it.
Spoiler alert, but right. Don't go away.
About Rey's place in the universe, about both having debates about things that are happening within the Star Wars universe and also how it reflects our universe, how the importance of a woman and an African-American man and the central importance in this movie and the obvious embrace of that by the entire world, what that represents about how we've changed as a society and as a culture in the last 38 years. So I think that at this point, it has become so much a part of our cultural DNA that it's almost impossible not to have these larger conversations around it. It's interesting that Maria brought up Harry Potter and Tolkien's world and the Hunger Games, because those are all worlds that I'm aware of but never dove into. And so I've seen SNL skits about those, and I haven't gotten the references. I think it's almost impossible to be alive and not get a reference to I Am Your Father or to a lightsaber or to the dark side.
There is no try.
Right. There is only do and not do. Exactly. You know, my son, who has never seen any of the movies, can quote Yoda. Which I'm sure has nothing to do with my continual repeating of the lines.
For what it's worth, I saw number 1, I saw number 7 two nights ago, and I'm starting life all over again. Between times, I went back to Henry James, and I'm just beginning to realize what I missed. Coming up, Steve Burt's close reading of Rey, the new female protagonist, a version of Luke Skywalker in The Force Awakens. Whose child is this? And how is she repurposing the old story to make a new one? And by the way, briefly, a material scientist we know had one of a thousand angles on the new film that blew right past me, and I was listening this time.
My name is Debbie Chatra. I'm a professor at the Olin College of Engineering outside Boston, and I've been a science fiction reader and fan my entire life. One of the things that I didn't notice when I was a child watching the Star Wars series, but I certainly notice now, is how robots are treated. In the earlier movies, there's no question that they were slaves, and they were treated terribly. They can be bought and they can be sold. They can be tasked at the will of their owner. They can be disassembled. They are absolutely slaves in the Star Wars universe. And so one of the things that I noticed about Force Awakens, they sort of sidestepped this issue of the morality of enslaving them. And in the new movie, BB-8, which is the soccer ball robot, is treated somewhat differently than C-3PO and R2-D2 were, and is mostly just treated as a sentient being. Since the very first Star Wars movie came out, we have a very different relationship to robots. And I think Pixar actually probably has a lot to do with the fact that we're starting to think of robots in the same sort of place as pets. They are not human, but creatures deserving of our sort of empathy and fellowship. So I suspect that what's changed is, in the last 40 years, the degree to which we've welcomed computers and robots into our lives and how we interact with them, whether it's Siri or Roombas. And so we are starting to grapple with this idea of how do we behave morally towards sentient machinery, whereas I think that was really unquestioned or unexamined in 1977 when the first movie came out.
That was the engineer and teacher, Deb Chatra. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, taking on the new Star Wars, layer by layer, role by role. Steve Burt, the young poet and omnivorous culture buff in the Harvard English department, can help you close read Beowulf and also The Simpsons. He had just watched The Force Awakens with his wife and grade school kids when we asked him this week what they went looking for and what they found.
You had to see Han, you had to see General Leia, you eventually had to see Luke, you had to see the Millennium Falcon, you had to see not only a thing that behaved like a Death Star, but a sort of catwalk, climactic lightsaber fight scene. You had to see an Imperial Star Destroyer, you had to see a small craft flee an Imperial Star Destroyer at the beginning of the movie, and you had to see that craft crash land on a desert planet where there was someone who felt like she or he had been forgotten by fate, who then discovered their destiny. There had to be a cantina scene with music and a lot of different aliens and so on. I liked the movie the most when it was able to focus the most either on Finn or on Rey or on their interactions.
I was raised to do one thing, but I've got nothing to fight for.
The character of Finn responds in so many ways to flaws or holes or problems with the original trilogy. It was never entirely clear if you just saw the Star Wars films, how much and under what circumstances these stormtroopers should be viewed as real people with agency, whether some of them were less than human or to be viewed as cannon fodder and it's fine to cut them in half with lightsabers and kill them.
You don't know a thing about me, what I've seen. We all need to run.
This film makes clear that in the Abrams Star Wars universe, the stormtroopers are people, and it's sad that a lot of them have to die in a war. I was personally more moved by the story around Rey. I am hoping, as I know some other critics are hoping, that Rey does not turn out to be Luke's child or somebody's child or anybody's child, that having the Force is not just like being a Bush or a Clinton, that it can happen to anyone. The dynastic aspects of the Star Wars story are not my favorites, for the same reason that having presidents named Bush and Clinton forever would not be my favorite fate for America. I would like to see a more democratic story about who can be important and who is favored by divine powers. Now, we don't know. What we do know about Rey is that she got stuck on this planet with not much to do except try to survive. Her title, the thing she says she is a scavenger. She has figured out how to earn a living, or at least get enough to eat, by repurposing, by taking and making her own various kinds of futuristic technology. And she gets to be part of the main Star Wars story and gets to literally be part of a relaunch for literally the most famous vehicle in the Star Wars universe. And where I have been trying to go with this is that Rey turns out to allegorize the fan experience. If you are a Star Wars fan, you've been stuck for a while. You felt abandoned, at least by the cinematic universe. You've been waiting for it to catch up to you, and you've been repurposing the old science fiction stuff, waiting around, deserted as it were, for the vehicle to relaunch. So Rey is not only, as Luke was, a figure with a destiny. She is, as Luke was not, and as Star Wars fans certainly are, a figure who is aware of the Star Wars mythology, who has been repurposing it and trying to make it her own for some time, and who really just can't wait to get back into space, which is, of course, what happens. So that's a lot of fun.
That's Steve Burt at Harvard, best known as a modern poetry critic. Maria, what do you make of the Rey arrival?
Rey, this new trio is just sensational. Notice that they all have gender-neutral names. And
Rey means king in Spanish, though.
Up until now, well, great. Yeah, up until now, it's been all about politics and edible battles. Enter Rey. And how are you going to reconfigure those? You're going to need a maternal figure, probably, and you'll have mother-daughter generational rivalry. I actually love the fact that that Star Wars brings us the flow of generations, because it replicates what goes on in the theaters, where sons are taking their fathers, grandmothers are taking their grandchildren, and there's a kind of binding and bonding power to the film. And then Rey as a scavenger. She is what the anthropologists call the bricoleur, taking bits and pieces, yes, just like George Lucas did, and creating something entirely new.
Only Steve Burt, among people I know, would have noticed that she is enacting the screenwriter's
it's
project.
It's completely meta, as they say these days.
It's so meta. Seth, introduce, well, I want to hear you on Rey, but then we got to talk about Finn, too.
I love Rey. I think that I love Rey for a whole number of reasons. I think she's one of the strongest, most interesting characters in herself that we've seen in this universe for a long time. I also love Rey for how she's exposed a lot of fault lines within our culture. For instance, Hasbro's incredibly lame and pathetic excuses for why they did not include a Rey figure in their Monopoly set or in other Star Wars sets that they put out, where they included Darth Vader, Kylo Ren, Luke, and Finn. And they claim they didn't want to spoil plot points, which, when you realize that she was a central figure on the poster, doesn't add up. I think one of the things that Rey is doing is illustrating how a lot of our conceptions about what made these movies popular, that they appeal to young boys, don't turn out not to be true. This movie has gotten high ratings across the board. One of the groups it's polling highest among is women 25 and under. It has something like a 99% approval rating. And I think that's very notable.
What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that there is a first of all, that it's a good story. I think both genders respond really strongly to stories, but also that it has a female character who is nuanced, who does not look like a lot of the movie stars that you might expect to see in a big, huge, big budget movie. But one other thing I wanted to touch on is Rey's lineage, because I actually I could listen to Steve talk about anything, and I love talking about things with Steve, but I very much disagree with him about the dynastic aspect of Star Wars. I think that's really important to its appeal, because I think one of the things that people experience when seeing it is, if they are teenagers, it resonates in the way that a teenager struggle with his or her parents feels like a worldwide struggle for domination. So that resonates on a very personal level. And I think even when you grow up and when you're an adult, as a parent, you can recognize that struggle, or you can recall that struggle with your children. So, and I also think that there have been throughout Star Wars important, crucially important characters who were not dynastic, Han Solo being one of them, obviously. My favorite theory about Rey is that she's actually a Kenobi. And I think there are a lot of hints towards that in the movie. She is...
In this movie so far?
In this movie so far, yeah.
Wow.
She's the only actor, British actor, who speaks with a British accent, who is also on the good side, except for Alec Guinness. The actor who plays Finn is also a British actor, and he speaks in an American accent. Liam Neeson spoke in an American accent. So you have that. You have both Ewan McGregor and Alec Guinness talking to her in that force back scene where she gets Luke's lightsaber. You have her dress. You have her being a nomad. So I think there are a lot of potential hints towards that.
But
and I would
the,
love
is
that.
Is the force democratic? It was really Steve's question. Does it? Does grace fall on everybody, anybody?
Well, there is the force is interesting. One of the things that we that is unclear is how actually people sense the force, if it can be learned, or if it's something that you're born with.
Thrust upon you.
And that issue with Anakin Skywalker is sort of ignored completely, because that was a virgin birth, or that's how it's at least described in the movie. But the Force does seem to be democratic in that it doesn't only fall on one caste, on one species. You know, in the prequel trilogy, you saw all sorts of different species being Jedis, Yoda obviously being a Jedi. It doesn't discriminate on height or appearance or anything else. So I would argue that it is democratic. It's something that you are born with, but it doesn't necessarily have to pass down through Mendelian genetics.
So it was that same Steve Burt in his English office at Harvard who told us this week, one of the best Star Wars conversations out there is on a sci-fi podcast called Imaginary Worlds, hosted by the public radio producer Eric Molinsky, who joins us by phone from New York. Welcome, Eric Molinsky.
Thank you.
Would you pull on the Rey and the Finn threads that Steve Burt and our guests were talking about? I mean, these new characters.
Can I pull in another thread that's somehow attached? Is I was actually really fascinated by Kylo Ren, who ties into a lot of this. He's the villain of the movie, and yep. Again, these are all spoiler alerts. But we find out that he's actually the child of General Leia and Han Solo. That his real name is Ben Solo, and in the way that Rey is. I totally agree that she is kind of in this meta way of standing for the viewer, and also sort of the legacy of Star Wars heroes thrusted upon her. Kylo Ren is a character who is dying to be the new Darth Vader, who's dying to live, but also crushed with the weight of those expectations and worried that he's not living up to it, which I think is also kind of fascinating because of all the family dynamics going on. At the same time, it is a kind of meta relationship he's having with you, the viewer. Yes, I know Darth Vader's not here. Yes, I know I'm here. I'm really worried you won't hate me as much as Darth Vader. Please hate me as much as Darth Vader, which I found completely fascinating.
We're posing about, you know, who is found by the light, but how does a child of Han Solo and Leia go to the dark side? What's the logic there?
Well, I think to some extent you could look at the whole series as about this. There's like this darkness in the Skywalker family, and it comes out in different generations. And it could skip a generation, but it's there, and it's something to grapple with for the other family members of whoever turns to the dark side, and for that person as well. And I think that also is something a lot of people can relate to. I mean, obviously not as drastic as what happens with the Skywalker family, but on a subtle metaphorical level.
Eric Malinsky, I wish you'd speak about Finn, the stormtrooper with African mm-hmm. features who defects to the Rebel Alliance. He's a new good guy, and obviously cast for great things coming ahead.
Yeah, and incredibly charming, too.
Yep, modest.
Really fun, and I think in a way it does fit that Han Solo role, actually, as the sort of outsider who comes into this world, who doesn't come in with the special powers necessarily, but what he brings are just great human qualities.
And what significance that finally there is a black star in this saga?
Huge. I mean, I think everybody else has spoken to it pretty well. It's, just seeing the posters and having Finn and Rey, I mean, a black man and a woman, white woman, as the central figures, it's a big change. And just seeing little action figures everywhere of them. I mean, not enough of Rey, God knows, really not enough of Rey, but of Finn, seeing lots of them. For me, that's really exciting.
I want to put this to Maria. I thought it was very clever to be struck that Rey derives somehow from the image of Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, played by Judy Garland in another mythic movie. Dorothy sings Over the Rainbow, kind of heartsick, to get back to Kansas. But Rey, who presents herself rather like Dorothy, says no to going home. She feels another destiny, and that again is sort of casting the picture forward. But
first of all, the film is so self-reflexive; it's constantly quoting other sources. So actually, when you mentioned Dorothy and Wizard of Oz, and here's where all this cross-identification takes place, I think of Harrison Ford saying, "We're home, Chewie." I mean, it's really...
As in, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto?
Exactly, yeah. And so there it is. And, Rey, I think, is going to become a deeply complicated figure who's going to engage in battles of her own, who has a future, that we all sort of map out in our imaginations. And the great thing is that this film makes fanboys and fangirls of us. So already in those, when we heard the kids' voices, they were already performing versions of the film and creating their own sequels and prequels and reboots and mashups and all of that.
What do we call it? Fan fiction.
Fan fiction, right.
Well, I just wanted to touch on one of the things that Eric said about Kylo Ren, and I agree. I thought he was an enormously compelling character. I also thought that he highlighted how, even within the Anakin Skywalker Darth Vader character, there is this constant struggle. And one of the ways that the Emperor brought Darth Vader over to the dark side was by telling him that that was something that would bring order to the universe, not that it would bring destruction. And so even though you have dark and light clearly set up as good and evil, it's not always clear that adherents to the dark side believe that they are forces for evil. And there's a crucial, in Rey's Force flashback, there's what I would assume is going to be a crucial plot point at some point where it appears that Rey is about to be killed by one of the Knights of Ren, and Kylo Ren then thrusts his lightsaber through Rey's would-be assassin. So the struggle, I think, between good and evil, but also between those two characters, Kylo Ren and Rey, I think is going to be really crucial.
So she's a re-embodiment in a certain way of Luke Skywalker. I want to hear more about Finn, who seems to be a re-embodiment of Han Solo. Could that be? Or Eric, do you want to grab that?
Yeah, just in terms of being just sort of the wild card to some extent. And I think his destiny is not quite clear, which I think is the most fascinating thing for me about that character. He isn't actually burdened. He is a free man, in which case, you know, it may be actually powerful casting that he's African-American. I mean, he's essentially had been in, you know, and his memory erased temporarily and taken from his home, and he essentially liberates himself from being a stormtrooper and has this incredible freedom to do whatever he wants now. And I think that's very exciting for this character, and it's going to be exciting to watch, because there is no blueprint in a way that these other characters who are weighted by the history of Star Wars and their own lineage, you know, are going to have to grapple with.
We assume that Han Solo is not coming back from that fall, although Sherlock Holmes did. But he also got a mad stab there with the lightsaber. He's over, I gather. Maybe that's why he
got $20 million as well.
Yeah, right. That's what I was going to say. He got paid better because it was a one and done for him. So I would think that he's not coming back. And even in the Star Wars universe, it would be hard to explain how he survives.
Do you want to bet on it, Rhea?
Oh, well,
I think
his ghost will come back, or possibly a flashback, yeah.
But don't we think Finn, F.N. Finn, is the ghost in some dimension?
Oh, interesting.
Listen to that music.
I had, of course, thought of Huckleberry Finn.
Oh!
I mean, again, this sort of cross-identification and this mixing up of roles.
Coming up. The cultural and geotype politics in Star Wars, going back to George Lucas's lessons of Vietnam. You can feel this 2016 campaign in the movie, too, if you want. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lightman. This is Open Source, the Star Wars edition. So what is the foundation of political ideas under the fantasy here? The definitions of us and them, who gets what, and the implications about power and rank and the direction of this world all around us. We like Jeet Heer's eye on such things. He's a man of Indian education and accent, resident in Toronto. He writes for the New Republic.
Hollywood these days makes most of its money abroad. You can't have a real blockbuster that isn't also a hit in Europe and Asia and South America. And one of the interesting things about Star Wars, going back to the first movie, is that it depicts a sort of pluralistic, multicultural world, or not just multicultural of different human cultures, but different alien cultures. There's that great scene in the first Star Wars movie where they go into the bar, the cantina, and there's like all these different aliens of different cultures mingling and mixing, and that really continues throughout the whole series. So the galaxy far, far away that Star Wars imagines speaks to the increasingly globalized, pluralistic world that everybody is experiencing. You can't separate it from the fact that it appeared in the 1970s in the sort of aftermath of the 60s, and George Lucas called himself very much a 60s person. He grew up with all that pulp culture and the serials and the adventure, and I think Star Wars was his way of trying to merge everything, merge his hippie politics with the stuff that he really loved when he was 5 years old, and speaks to both its appeal, but also maybe its limits. So there's a kind of anti-war politics. You know, you have like this vast empire that is fighting these rebels, but it's also children's culture. It's done at the most universal level. That allows it to be inverted. So even though Lucas himself had this kind of left liberal perspective where the empire is sort of like Kissinger and Nixon and the Ewoks are the Viet Cong, you know, by the time the 80s rolled around, Ronald Reagan was able to co-opt Star Wars and say, well, we're fighting the evil empire and we have our own Star Wars program that will allow us to defeat the commies. It speaks to the ambivalence of the United States during the Vietnam era, that Americans don't like to think of themselves as an imperial power, but rather as rebels against the empire. And if you remember the original Star Wars, the empire, they all spoke with British accents. The heroes are these rebels who are Midwesterners. There is a sense in which it co-opted the anti-imperialist politics of the 60s and 70s and once again cast the sort of white Americans as the heroes. the most interesting reappropriation of Star Wars came from the neoconservatives, who have done a whole bunch of essays in, you know, places like the Weekly Standard, which, you know, sort of say, well, the Empire was good. They were trying to bring order to the galaxy, and the rebels are kind of like jihadis. You know, people like Luke Skywalker are radicalized and fall under the prey of radical clerics and become messianic religious figures. The insidious thing about Star Wars is it allows Americans to think of themselves as being rebels rather than the Empire. In some ways, I'm sympathetic to the neoconservative interpretation because I think it's, in some ways, it's more honest. It says that, like, if we really look at ourselves in the mirror, you know, we're not Luke Skywalker, we're Darth Vader, and, you know, we should own who we are. Our drones and the Pentagon, you know, these are the Death Star. These are the technological weapons of mass destruction that are used to shock and awe the world.
That was Jeet Heer of the New Republic. Closer to home, a writer and editor of very Bostonian erudition, Alan Andres, called in with a contrary take on the Star Wars project, which he has been watching warily since the 70s.
It's interesting to think of Star Wars when it came out in 1977 and all of the cultural events that surrounded it. I mean, only, what, 8 years earlier, man had landed on the moon. But in those 8 years, we'd had Chappaquiddick, the Pentagon Papers, Revelations, Watergate, the Church Committee hearings that disclosed all the dirty laundry of the CIA, then D. Edgar Hoover's death and the FBI revelations, and then, remember, Judith Campbell Exner came forward, and then we found all about all the dark secret of Camelot, and then later, right after Star Wars, but heading right into the sequels with the Iran hostages, there was the oil crisis, and then there was inflation at Gerald Ford's win buttons and the Three Mile Island. I mean, it was a period of just depressing news about the state of the United States and the world, and what, 2 years later, even in space, Skylab fell out of the sky. So for a lot of people, Star Wars was the one bit of escapism they could feel good about. I saw Star Wars 3 times in the theater in 1977. I was a huge science fiction fan. I was so excited when this film opened. I remember reading the review in the Times the day it opened. And I went and saw the film, and the special effects were dazzling. But I got to tell you that that film really bothered me at the time, and it's bothered me in the many years since. Star Wars has probably the worst instance of genocide ever committed to celluloid. They blow up this planet to demonstrate the capability of the Death Star, and Princess Leia blanches and goes, "Ugh, horrible." And then it's mentioned like once more in the film, and everything moves on. The sensibility just bothered me, because here it is, you had an entire planet being wiped out, and it's only used as a plot device. And it just seemed to me that there was no moral center in the film. Essentially, all it was a play to just give razzle-dazzle entertainment.
That was the Boston-based editor, Alan Andres. Eric Molinsky, anybody want to, I mean, starting with you, jump in with a sort of a buzzkill on all the celebration.
Well, it's funny because I actually interviewed one of those writers, the conservative writers that was mentioned earlier, who did write an essay, kind of, I do think to some extent, tongue-in-cheek, defending the destruction of Alderaan, and also claiming that Princess Leia did lie about everything to Grand Moff Tarkin and Darth Vader. So therefore, the idea that Alderaan was a peaceful planet, possibly not. It could have simply been a well-armed planet full of insurgents. You know, I actually do think that the deaths of all those people, it's felt by Obi-Wan Kenobi. I do think that it is there. It's simply not a movie that there is a lot of mourning on. Even after Ben Kenobi gets killed, they have this really fun space battle fight. I think it's not quite in the nature of the films, but it is there.
I got to just say, agreeing with Alan Andres, I mean, it is a picture in endless detail of exactly what we worry about in the Middle East and the world, is sort of endless, endless war.
Well, although,
and then get ready for the next one.
I mean, I think the endless detail part is interesting, because until this movie, we have never seen blood in the Star Wars universe. I guess with one very slight exception, when Luke's aggressor's arm is cut off in the cantina in Mos Eisley. So it's not a world in which violence is portrayed even remotely realistically. People are shot with blasters and they just sort of collapse. Obi-Wan is struck down and he just vaporizes. So I'm not sure that I would agree, or I think I would not agree with the notion that this has a cavalier attitude towards the death of the planet as much as it does a sort of pulp sensibility, which is very much the tradition that George Lucas was harking back to about violence in general.
Who wants to take a stab at reading the theology in the Force itself, maybe as the Holy Spirit, maybe as in the Force be with you, as a translation of Dominus Vobiscum in the Latin Mass.
And
the Force is
you.
Grace, as in the news of the Gospels, that the kingdom of God is within you.
Well, I love going in the direction from going from history to myth. And I just want to say that the mythological imagination is abstract. So everything in this film, in myths in general, is larger than life and twice as unnatural. And because the mythological imagination is abstract, you can project anything you want onto it. So you can see the Star Wars franchise as an allegory of fascism. You can read it as something about U.S. politics. I would say almost anything goes. The genius of Lucas was to give us a side that is long ago and far away. To me, that explains the global appeal of the story.
But what of the divine?
I think the
implications of the divine.
One of the things about the Force is it's essentially, you know, fortune cookie theology. It's the most kind of namby-pamby expression of good and evil in religion as you can get. It's essentially whatever you want to believe at any given moment, that's what the Force is representing. It can represent seemingly almost pure evil and almost pure goodness. It is a force, a life force that extends throughout the galaxy. I think one of the reasons it's had such broad appeal is because it doesn't matter what religious background you fall into, you can see some aspect of that within the Force and within the Star Wars universe.
I think there's something galvanizing about the Force, though, in the sense that it gives you a sense of belonging, that you belong, the idea that you belong to something greater, so long as that's a very broad, general, vague greater. I think a lot of people can, it's almost like an antidote to apathy and loneliness.
I'm wondering whether there's a turn in the fortunes overall here, and maybe about us, maybe about the movie, and specifically about Luke Skywalker. And I wondered at the end, has he come back as a twisted force of evil himself? Our friend Steve Burt has the last word here on Luke at middle age, as we see him reappear finally in the closing frames of Star Wars 7. It's what we came to see. The years have taken their toll, obviously, but we learn nothing of what he's been through. He does not speak. It's another of those interesting moments when The Force Awakens feels almost like an old-time silent movie.
It is a moment that invites us to ask what is going on in Luke's head, although it is also an interesting moment because Luke, by the time of The Force Awakens, is no longer, I think, a figure for audience identification. He has undergone a process which is, how does a student become a master? How does a kid become a grown-up? How does someone who was learning become someone who is teaching? That has happened to Luke, and that means he's no longer someone who you feel that you resemble if you're 10 in The Force Awakens. He's someone who's learned stuff that you don't know. And again, the plot allegorizes the fan experience. Rey is a fan. Luke is no longer the fan. Rey is seeing the gang get back together and the vehicle take off. Luke has seen things that you haven't seen. We don't know what has happened to Luke between the end of Return and the beginning of The Force Awakens. Luke is not someone whose head you can easily inhabit if you are a fan watching The Force Awakens. He's someone where you want to know what happened, and you don't know, unless I missed a lot of big honking clues, and I do often miss big honking clues.
Anybody hear a big honking clue here about Luke before we're done?
Well, I love that notion of silence that gets us talking. And suddenly we leave the movie theater with a riddle wrapped in a mystery, in an enigma. And what do we do? Well, there's a moment of silence as you march out, as you file out. But then immediately you want to, you know, figure out what the other person thought about this moment of silence. And, you know, figure out the whole movie. So that's what I love about that ending.
I don't think it's coincidental that probably perhaps one of the finest pieces of Mark Hamill's acting in the Star Wars movies has been when he has remained silent on screen.
Yes, yes, yes. As the double suns go down.
Right, and in the end of The Force Awakens. But just one last thing I wanted to touch on was this sense of belonging to something greater. I think in a lot of ways that really holds the key to Star Wars' appeal. You can feel like you look, you know, you can feel like you look short and are gangly and talk funny and you fit into Star Wars. You can feel like you're an overgrown ape with hair sprouting out of your body in every which way and you can't make people understand you and you fit into Star Wars. And because it has become such an all-encompassing cultural phenomena, there is now a whole Talmudic level of discussion that takes place far outside of the, quote, canonical Star Wars universe, where people hold very, very serious, detailed philosophical discussions about all of these questions that we're talking about. And I think that's
a Protestant movement in the Star Wars community.
I'm not sure about that, but I mean, even, you know, a slightly humorous example, but one that I think now, when I checked earlier, had something like 300,000 followers is Emo Kylo Ren, a Twitter character who does things like say, "Dad, everyone knows parsecs are units of distance and not time." You know, wherever you fall in society, you can find a way to fit into Star Wars. And I think that's been really crucial to its appeal.
Eric Molinsky in New York, what do you see as the future for Luke? And why do I think it could be very dark indeed?
You know, it's funny. My thinking about Luke was I kept thinking back to The Empire Strikes Back, where he abandons his training very quickly because he has a vision of Han and Leia in danger, and he says he has to rush out to save them. And Yoda says, "This is a terrible idea. You don't cut short your training. You've just started. You're not ready." And he does it anyway. And they say this is very ominous. And it didn't seem that bad. I mean, he got his hand chopped off, but learned that Darth Vader was his father, came back and eventually defeated Darth Vader, turned him to the light, defeats the Emperor and the Empire. And there was there was almost like this big thread dangling of, well, what was so terrible that he cut short his training? But I think what happened, my guess as to what happened in the 30 years in between, was that he was not really truly qualified and trained to be a Jedi Master, not truly qualified to restart a Jedi Academy and prevent his nephew from going to the dark side. And because of this rash decision he made as a young man, the Empire rises from the ashes with a new Darth Vader and a new Death Star that's 10 times worse. And my guess is that he feels an enormous sense of guilt about what happened. And to me, you know, as a child, I mean, Luke was the character I identified with the most because of this, the incredible, his impatience, sadly, identified with, and also just the sense of incredible possibility and what is out there beyond those twin suns of Tatooine for me. And now as a middle-aged man, I mean, I don't have regrets like that in my life, but just the idea that you've lived a life now and certain choices you've made, these are the choices you've made, and that part of your history has been written across his face, I thought was really, as a middle-aged man and a lifelong Star Wars fan, I found that incredibly poignant. Well, at the same time, you do have characters like Rey and Finn who have so much possibility ahead of them. So the franchise continues to grow with the generations, which I think is poignant and beautiful.
Last word, Seth Mnookin.
One that Eric would have been allowed to come to my 6-year-old birthday party if he came as Luke. But harking back to what Deb said and what she was talking about technology, I do think one interesting thing in that final shot is we're taught in the initial trilogy that Darth Vader, that the meld of man and machine is somehow part of what makes him evil. And I think it's curious that when you last see Luke on that shot on the island – you see that his hand is now a mechanical hand and is no longer the simulacrum of a human hand that he had when it was initially cut off.
Maria Tatar, in a word.
I want to loop back to theology. This is a secular entertainment, and I love the fact that what the Force really is to me is courage, cunning, using your wits and intelligence.
I'm just glad he didn't say, pull a Schwarzenegger and say, I'll be back. But of course, he will be. The schedule says May 26, 2017 for Star Wars 8. We would love to watch it with you. Thank you, Maria Tatar, Seth Mnookin, Eric Malinsky. Thanks also to Dave Eggers, Amanda Palmer, Deb Chatra, Steve Burt, Jed Heer, and Alan Andres. Thanks also to Keith Phipps, S.I. Rosenbaum, and Calvin McCreevan in Birmingham. You can help support a new year of open source with your hard-earned credits, radioopensource.org/donate. Our show is produced by the rogue squadron of Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Pat Tomeno, and Zach Goldhammer. George Hicks is our Wookiee co-pilot on the audio mixer. Mary McGrath, our Jedi Master. Help us, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're our only hope. I'm Christopher Lydon.